This is the New York Times. Universities Grapple with Message of Protests by Catherine Rossman. In a video shared widely online, a leader of the pro-Palestinian student movement at Columbia University stands near the center of a lawn on the campus and calls out, "We have Zionists who have entered the camp." Dozens of protesters who have created a tent village called the Gaza Solidarity Encampment repeat his words back to him, "We have Zionists who have entered the camp." "Walk and take a step forward," the leader says, as the students continue to repeat his every utterance, "so that we can start to push them out of the camp." The protesters link arms and march in formation toward three Jewish students who have come inside the encampment. "It was really scary because we had like 75 people quickly gathering around, encircling us, doing exactly what he said to do," Avi Weinberg, one of the Jewish students, said in an interview. He and his friends had gone to see the encampment, not intending to provoke, he said. When it began to feel tense, one of the students started to record the encounter. They are not sure precisely how the protest leader determined they were supportive of Israel. "Suddenly, we are being called the Zionists in their encampment," Mr. Weinberg said. He put a target on our back. On Thursday, the incident took on new significance when a video from January resurfaced on social media showing the same protest leader, Kamani James, saying, "Zionists don't deserve to live, and be grateful that I'm not just going out and murdering Zionists." The next day, Columbia officials announced they had barred Mr. James from campus. Columbia has been ground zero in a national student movement against Israelis' treatment of Palestinians, with protesters setting up encampments on campuses across the country. Hundreds of demonstrators at Columbia, Yale, Emerson College, the University of Southern California, and beyond have been arrested. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators across the country say Israel is committing what they see as genocide against the Palestinian people, and they aim to keep a spotlight on the suffering. But some Jewish students who support Israel and what they see as its right to defend itself against Hamas say the protests have made them afraid to walk freely on campus. They hear denunciations of Zionism and calls for a Palestinian uprising as an attack on Jews themselves. The tension goes to the heart of a question that has touched off debate among observers and critics of the protests. At what point do pro-Palestinian political speech in time of war cross the line into the type of anti-Semitism colleges have vowed to combat? If this is a matter that has vexed political leaders, university administrators, and some Jewish college students, inside the encampments, the very notion of anti-Semitism is barely discussed, in part because the demonstrators do not believe the label applies to their activism. Protest leaders point to the involvement of Jewish student activists and challenge the idea that the comfort of Israel's supporters should be a concern. And they draw a distinction between anti-Zionism, which describes opposition to the Jewish state of Israel, and hatred toward Jewish people in general. It is an argument many Jews see as a fig leaf for bigotry. In a letter to Columbia students last week, university officials made clear the challenge they are facing. "We know that many of you feel threatened by the atmosphere and the language being used and have had to leave campus," they wrote. "This is unacceptable." They continued, "Chants, signs, taunts, and social media posts from our own students that mock and threaten to kill Jewish people are totally unacceptable, and in Columbia, and Columbia students who are involved in such incidents will be held accountable." A call for divestment. The protests beyond New York City have been inspired by Columbia students, but they are largely diffuse and spreading via social media, much like recent movements including Black Lives Matter and the Arab Spring. At Columbia, the demonstration is led by a group known as QAD, Columbia University Apartheid Divest, a coalition representing more than 100 Columbia student organizations, including Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace. Leadership is amorphous. The organizers communicate on the Telegram messaging app and provide media training to the activists they make available to speak to the press. It is unclear what financial support the group receives and from whom. When asked, one student leader declined to comment. But supporters from across New York have responded to the group's Instagram pleas for water, blankets, gloves, and cigarettes. Last week, Palestine Legal, an advocacy group, filed a federal civil rights complaint on behalf of the protesters, arguing that they have been subjected to anti-Palestinian and anti-Islamic harassment on campus. Student demonstrators are specifically calling for their universities to make transparent all financial holdings and divest from companies and funds they say are profiting from or supporting Israel and its government policies. They also want amnesty for students and faculty who have been disciplined by the university as a result of their protest. At Columbia, students are also calling on the university to end its 5-year dual degree program with Tel Aviv University. Some also object to the presence on the university board of Jay Johnson, who served as Homeland Security Secretary during the Obama administration, and sits on the board of Lockheed Martin, a supplier of fighter jets to the Israeli Defense Force. Mr. Johnson declined to comment. At encampments around the country, signs also point to the broader politics of many of the protesters. They support anti-Israel boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which predates the war in Gaza. The students evoke historical issues of colonialism and apartheid. Student activists who are not themselves Palestinian say that they have joined the movement for a wide variety of reasons: anguish over humanitarian crisis in Gaza, a rebuke of university and police response to protests, a commitment to intersectional justice where any group's fight should be everyone's fight, the idealistic desire to be a part of a community effort, and a sense that the fight for Palestinians is a continuation of the work started on the behalf of oppressed people during the Black Lives Matter movement. Many Jewish students taking part in the current protests say they are doing so as an expression of their Jewish values that emphasize social justice and equality. Encampments have hosted Shabbat dinners and Passover cedars. At Columbia, one student said that donors have supplied kosher meals. Samuel Law, a graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin, who was Jewish and involved in the protest, was inspired by the encampments popping up around the country. "I strongly believe that the university should be there for us to care about what we care about," he said. They don't feel safe. Outside the pro-Palestinian encampments, the movement has drawn accusations of anti-Jewish bigotry and harassment from political leaders as well as from some students, Jewish and not. Jimmy Hayward, a Columbia freshman who is not Jewish, said that he has many friends studying at the Columbia-affiliated Jewish Theological Seminary who are unnerved. "I have friends in JTS that need to be walked to campus," he said. "They want me to walk them because they don't feel safe walking alone." Signs in and around Columbia encampments include inspirational quotes, including, "The world belongs to the people and the future belongs to us," attributed to Zhai Qing, a Chinese communist revolutionary. But there are also celebrations of violence like, "Whoever is in solidarity with our corpses but not our rockets is a hypocrite and not one of us." At the University of Michigan, some Jewish students said they felt rattled as they walked to class, passing by protesters chanting, "Long live Intifada," using the word for uprising in Arabic, which has been used to describe periods of often violent protests by Palestinians against Israelis. Tessa Wexler, a Jewish student at the University of California, Santa Barbara, was alarmed to see the school's multicultural center, a sign on the door to a student lounge that said, "Zionists not allowed." Campus protesters dispute the notion that their movement has made pro-Israel students unsafe. Nas Issa, a Columbia graduate who is supporting and advising protest organizers, sees a difference between feeling uncomfortable, and feeling that you are in danger, especially if you feel that your identity is tied to the practices of a particular state or to a political ideology. "That can be personally affecting, and I think it's understandable," said Ms. Issa, who is Palestinian. "But I think the conflation between that and safety, it can be a bit misleading." When pressed, the protesters say they are anti-Zionist, but not anti-Semitic. It is not a distinction everyone buys. "Let's take any other ethnic or religious minority," said Eden Yeager, a junior at Columbia. "Would you only accept them if they were willing to denounce an integral part of their religious or ethnic identity?" "The answer is absolutely not. So how come it's okay to say, you know, we accept Jews, but only if you denounce your religious and social and ethnic connection to your homeland? It's ridiculous. Last Tuesday afternoon, Isidore Carton, an Israeli Jew, hopped a fence and entered the pro-Palestinian encampment at Columbia. I think it's super important to go and show our side also, said Mr. Carton, a 2022 Columbia graduate. We should be allowed to be there as much as anyone else. Once inside, he unfurled an Israeli flag. A friend who had come with him toted a poster showing the faces and names of Israelis who were kidnapped into Gaza by Hamas on October 7th. As they did, they were trailed by pro-Palestinian protesters holding a large black sheet to keep journalists from seeing them and the flag. A few students, Mr. Carton said, chanted, "Burn Tel Aviv to the ground." And as he tried to talk to the demonstrators, he said his efforts were blocked by protest leaders. One of them was Kaimani James, the student who was later barred from campus for his incendiary video. "We don't engage with Zionists," he said, according to Mr. Carton. A wake-up call. Mr. James' video, which was publicized by a right-wing outlet on Thursday and then reported on by the New York Times and others, drew wide attention, including from President Biden, whose spokesman issued a statement saying, "These dangerous, appalling statements turn the stomach and should serve as a wake-up call." Others cautioned not to use the words of one activist to define a much larger group. The Reverend Michael McBride, a founder of Black Church PAC, who has pressed for ceasefire in Gaza, said Mr. James' comments were not representative of the anti-war movement. "You can go to a protest and find anything you're looking for," said the Reverend McBride, who leads a church in Berkeley, California. "If you're looking for that, then you'll find it." At Columbia, the QAD student protest organization on Friday posted a statement on Instagram that said, "Kamani's words in January do not reflect his view, our values, nor the encampment's community agreements." The statement added, "In the same way some of us were once Zionists and are now anti-Zionists, we believe unlearning is always possible. But for university administrators, Mr. James' case has presented a serious challenge." He made some of his comments about killing Zionists, including that taking someone's life in certain case scenarios is necessary and better for the overall world, during a college disciplinary hearing in January. But he was not barred from campus until the January video began to spread last week. A notification sent to Mr. James by the university and shared with the New York Times by one of his friends described it as an interim suspension. Mr. James, who said in a statement last week that his words were wrong, could not be reached for comment. When leadership learned the video, it took immediate steps to ban James from campus. A Columbia spokesman said this week, "We initiated disciplinary proceedings which encompass this and additional potential violations of university policies." It is not clear whether the Columbia administrator conducting the disciplinary hearing alerted a superior or public safety official to Mr. James' remarks at the time, or whether Columbia policy dictated that the administrator should have. A spokesman for the university declined to comment further. The episode left Avi Weinberg, the pro-Israel student who was surrounded by Mr. James and other protesters at the encampment, distressed. "The university was aware that this is his mindset, and the university put their students in danger," he said. "That is very present on my mind." Princeton Museum gets 6 new works. Site-specific pieces for the university's new building, which is set to open in 2025. By Hillary M. Sheets. Princeton University has a long history of commissioning public art by the likes of Henry Moore, Louise Nevelson, Alexander Calder, and Pablo Picasso, dating back to the 1960s. And when the Princeton University Art Museum opens to the public next year, it almost doubled the size of its original building. 6 new large-scale works by women and artists of color will have pride of place. Visible beacons near the building's perimeter, both indoors and out at this central crossroads on campus. The artworks include 4 site-specific commissions by Diana Al-Hadid, Nick Cave, Jane Irish, Tuan Andrew Nguyen, and 2 acquisitions by Jun Kaniko and Rose Simpson. From every access point toward the museum, there will be works of public art so that people can almost use them as visual markers of arrival, James Stewart's. Its director said, I was thinking about how to bring voices that maybe were not yet adequately represented on our campus, Stewart said. The new artworks help break down the distinctions between indoors and outdoors, he added, as part of the goal to enhance accessibility and engagement with the museum's encyclopedic collection. Some 115,000 objects. The Institute is renowned for its Chinese paintings, photography, and pre-Columbian holdings. The 1966 building was demolished in 2021 to make way for the new one. The museum has an annual operating budget of $29 million, 60% of which comes from endowment income, and has 120 employees expected to grow by 180 by the opening in 2025. 146,000 square foot building, which is divided into 9 interlocking pavilions for each building of its holdings, will place all of its collections galleries on the second floor, giving them parity. Nearly ignored in Stewart's tour was mention of the new building's designer, the Ghanaian-British architect David Ajay, acclaimed for the National Museum of African-American History and Culture in Washington. Last year, Ajay was accused of sexual misconduct by 3 former employees and has stepped back from day-to-day oversight on several projects. We were 50% through construction at the time of the allegations, Stewart said. We were obviously not going to tear the building down and start over again. It is credited to an Ajad Associates project, but Stewart said the architect is no longer involved and the remaining work is in the hands of collaborating architects Cooper Robertson. Similarly, the Studio Museum of Harlem's new building is near completion with Ajay Associates and Cooper Robertson. The Shelburne Museum in Vermont, on the other hand, which had hired Ajay to build its new Center for Native American Art, had barely begun the design process last year and chose to cut all ties with his firm. Princeton's building was fully funded 2/3 by private donors, 1/3 by the university before its groundbreaking in 2021. We have to reclaim our own values that have shaped the project, the director said. He suggested those values are embedded in the 4 new artist commissions, which each respond directly to the architecture in the collections. Cave is scaling up one of his vibrant sound suit figures to 40 feet tall. It will bow toward arriving visitors as part of a mosaic combining glass, wood, and metal that wraps around 2 walls of the entrance court. The fantastical form will be adorned in a costume of flowers with a halo of spinning tops and globes. I see this figure as the master of ceremonies that will welcome you, said Cave, a Chicago-based artist who titled his piece, Let Me Introduce Myself. They call me MC Prince Brighton. A cloudscape with 8 Adinkra symbols from West Africa, including ones for unity, peace, truth, and courage, surrounds the figure. Al-Hadid, a Syrian-born, New York-based sculptor, will create a ghostly ziggurat in aluminum rising 15 feet on the east terrace. I am interested in the suggestion that this ancient structure might lay stored in some ways buried, with a very contemporary new building, she said, explaining that she was inspired by objects in the museum's collection from near her birthplace in Aleppo and from Turkey. For a narrow double-height gallery above another entrance, Wynn has made a 20-foot-high kinetic mobile nodding to Calder. It will dangle over ancient mosaic embedded in the floor from the late 2nd century AD, which were discovered during excavations of Antioch in modern Turkey during the 1930s by a Princeton-led team. The polished discs of the mobile are modeled on unexploded ordnance from the Vietnam War that has killed many farmers in the decades. We have to reclaim our own values that shaped the project. Since part of the ongoing research by Nguyen, a Vietnam-based visual artist. It's the reincarnation of this bomb material left over from the detritus of war, said Nguyen, who has designed his sculpture with bells and mallets that will chime in the breeze. It kind of looks like this rising dragon responding to the old mosaic of Medusa on the ground. For a small viewing room, cantilevered from one of the second floor pavilions, Irish, who was based in Philadelphia, created Cosmos Beyond Atrocity, a Renaissance-style ceiling painting. Inside its architectural coffers, she painted vignettes of violence drawn from the museum's art collection, including Medea slaying her children, the Maitre d'Homme of St. Sebastian, and Judith beheading the Holofernese. So much of the Western canon of art is premised on such images. But her ceiling offers a different vision of the cosmos in the center, based on images of pacifism. The Trompe-l'Oeil composition appears to rip open in the middle, revealing an atmospheric sky populated with figures for the Vietnam anti-war movement in the United States. Stewart thinks that people walking down the sidewalk will see this gloriously colored ceiling and want to discover what it is. He said he hoped the day would come eventually when the role that Ajay played in the design of the building could be discussed without tainting the project. As a culture, we're going to have to grapple more successfully with how we deal with Meeker versus the work, Stewart said. If we were to apply the standards of today to the art of the past, our galleries would probably be decimated. Strong Dollar Weighing on World's Currencies, by Joe Renenson and Carl Russell. Every major currency in the world has fallen against the U.S. dollar this year, an unusually broad shift from the potential for serious consequences across the global economy. Two-thirds of the roughly 150 currencies tracked by Bloomberg have weakened against the dollar, whose recent strength stems from a shift in expectations about when and by how much the Federal Reserve may cut its benchmark interest rate, which sits around a 20-year high. High Fed rates, a response to stubborn inflation, mean that American assets offer better returns than much of the world, and investors need dollars to buy them. In recent months, money has flowed into the United States with a force that's being felt by policymakers, politicians, and people from Brussels to Beijing, Toronto to Tokyo. The dollar index, a common way to gauge the general strength of the U.S. currency against a basket of its major trading partners, is hovering at levels last seen in the early 2000s, when U.S. interest rates were also similarly high. The yen is at a 34-year low against the U.S. dollar. The euro and Canadian dollar are sagging. The Chinese yuan has shown notable signs of weakness despite officials stated intent to stabilize it. It has never been truer than the Fed is the world's central bank, said Jesse Rogers, an economist at Moody's Analytics. When the dollar strengthens, the effects can be fast and far-reaching. The dollar is on one side of nearly 90% of all foreign exchange transactions. A strengthening U.S. currency intensifies inflation abroad, as countries need to swap more of their own currencies for the same amount of dollar-dominated goods, which include imports from the United States as well as globally traded commodities like oil, often priced in dollars. Countries that have borrowed in dollars also face higher interest bills. There can be benefits for some foreign businesses, however. A strong dollar benefits exporters that sell to the United States, as Americans can afford to buy more foreign goods and services, including cheaper vacations. That puts American companies that sell abroad at a disadvantage, since their goods appear more expensive and could widen the U.S. trade deficit at a time when President Biden is promoting more domestic industry. Exactly how these positives and negatives shake out depends on why the dollar is stronger, and that depends on the reason U.S. interest rates might remain high. Earlier in the year, unexpectedly strong U.S. growth, which can lift the global economy, had begun to outweigh worries over stubborn inflation. But if U.S. rates remain high because inflation is sticky, even as economic growth slows, then the effects could be more sinister, and Kamakashi Trivedi, an analyst at Goldman Sachs. In the case, policymakers would be stuck between supporting their domestic economies by cutting rates or supporting their currency by keeping them high. We are at the cusp of that, Mr. Trivedi said. The strong dollar's effects have been felt particularly sharply in Asia. Last month, the finance ministers of Japan, South Korea, and the United States met in Washington, and among other things, they pledged to consult closely on foreign exchange market developments. Their post-meeting statement also noted the serious concerns of Japan and the Republic of Korea about the recent sharp depreciation of the Japanese yen and the Korean won. The Korean won is the weakest it has been since 2022, and the country's central bank governor recently called moves in the currency market excessive. The yen has been tumbling against the dollar and on Monday briefly slipped past 160 yen to the dollar for the first time since 1990. In sharp contrast to the Fed in the United States, Japan's central bank began raising interest rates only this year after struggling for decades of low growth. For Japanese officials, that means striking a delicate balance, increase rates, but not by too much in a way that could stifle growth. The consequence of that balancing act is a weakened currency as rates have stayed near zero. The risk is that if the yen continues to weaken, investors and consumers may lose confidence in the Japanese economy, shifting more of their money abroad. A similar risk looms for China, whose economy has been battered by real estate crisis and sluggish spending at home. The country, which seeks to hold its currency within a tight range, has recently relaxed its stance and allowed the yuan to weaken, a demonstration of the pressure exerted by the dollar in financial markets and on other countries' policy decisions. A weaker yuan is not a sign of strength, said Brad Setzer, a senior fellow at the Council for Foreign Relations and former Treasury Department economist. It will lead to questions about whether China's economy is as strong as people thought. In Europe, policymakers at the European Central Bank have signaled that they could cut rates at their next meeting in June. But even with inflation improving in the Eurozone, there is a concern among some that by lowering interest rates before the Fed, the ECB would widen difference in interest rates between the Eurozone and the United States, further weakening the euro. Gabrielle McAuliffe, governor of Ireland's central bank and one of the 26 members of the ECB's governing council, said that when setting policy, we can't ignore what's happening in the U.S. Other policymakers are confronting similar complications with central banks in South Korea and Thailand, among those also considering lowering interest rates. By contrast, Indonesia's central bank unexpectedly raised rates last week in part to support the country's depreciating currency, a sign of how the dollar's strength is reverberating around the world in different ways. Some of the fast-falling currencies this year, like those in Egypt, Lebanon, and Nigeria, reflect domestic challenges made even more daunting by the pressure exerted by a stronger dollar. "We are on the edge of a storm," Mr. Rogers of Moody's said. "I let TikTok influencers tell me where to eat. How much could I trust their suggestions? Just let me finish this sandwich and I'll tell you," by Becky Hughes. TikTok is many things, a place for slime videos, a free therapy session, the leading source of information in America right now, and for some, the ultimate restaurant resource. With a properly tuned algorithm, TikTok can become a never-ending scroll of rhythmic recommendations from critics of varying reliability, many of whom have been paid by restaurants for their PR-approved opinions. How trustworthy are their suggestions, really? And what can a diner expect from these spots when videos have promised them perfect vibes, hot singles, and even religious enlightenment? To find out, I spent hours on TikTok, going down a digital rabbit hole of restaurant videos, then dined for a week at the whim of my For You page. New York's hottest new restaurant, Medusa Mediterranean. Thistle Swan and Jacob Cummings, who met on Hinge, put their faith in the internet once more to choose their anniversary dinner local. "I just looked up fancy restaurants on TikTok," Mr. Cummings said. "I don't know anything about fancy culture, but I could tell by looking at the place that it was dummy fancy." That's how the couple, both 25, found themselves below a huge fake tree sprouting from the middle of the dining room at Medusa, a club restaurant in the meatpacking district with a strict dress code, no sweatpants, shorts, or jerseys, and a pricey raw bar. Medusa's website calls it a dining experience that takes you on a journey to a world of sunlit coasts, sparkling waters, and vibrant culture. "I didn't find any geographic marvels, but I was surprised to find the food. Shiso, tzatziki, lamb chops with chimichurri, Wagyu kofta, terrific. The couple agreed. Though admittedly they never go out for nice dinners, Mr. Cummings is unemployed and Miss Swan teaches ceramics and caters. But Mr. Cummings said at the end of the meal, I'm going to be honest, it was not $800 delicious. TikTok did mislead me in one way. A few videos called it a perfect date-night spot, but it's nearly impossible to flirt over the echoing, continuous beat of the lyricless tracks spun by Bleach Blonde DJ. On top of that, a violinist wearing, incidentally, a TikTok viral dress, traipsed through the dining room, stopping at tables of diners with their phones out and grinning as she performed to the camera. Maybe not date-night material, but from a place I hadn't heard of beyond TikTok, a pleasant surprise. Literally, a religious experience. Quality bistro. Your life will be forever changed, said Rebecca Schneider, who posts as Bouge Bist Only about a comped dinner at Quality Bistro, specifically the tableside butter service. Here's how the profound event begins. A server's cart over a bucket of half-foot mound of butter emerging from it. With a wooden spatula, the server scoops out a baseball-sized blob of butter, smears it into a marble plate, and tops it with piment de espelette, minced shallots, and salt. For $38, the butter plate comes with oiled toast radishes and a bouquet of their leaves, two dips, a cold leek dish, and slices of ham folded like linen napkins. The restaurant group, Quality Branded, had success with an influencer marketing campaign at Bad Roman in Columbus Circle, and the approach seems to be working at Quality Bistro too. On a recent Friday night, a woman from Kansas City was celebrating her 30th birthday at the restaurant after seeing it in a video. I wouldn't say I found God at Quality Bistro, but more disappointingly, I didn't find a husband. After seeing a number of videos mention the hunky clientele, Ariana Nathani said, everybody here is a finance daddy, and Tiff Barra called it the best NYC restaurant to meet eligible bachelors. I found only groups of millennial women drinking espresso martinis and families celebrating birthdays, sparklers in their desserts. Grab all your friends and sprint this bowl. Alternatively, power walk alone to this bowl, an Australian fast casual concept in NoHo. Spend $19 on a cardboard bowl of shredded cabbage and poached chicken with miso dressing that actually may surprise and delight you. It's worth waiting in the line, which often covers half of Bleecker Street, but moves quickly. After all, you'd be waiting in line for lunch anywhere else in the neighborhood, and you may, like me, get lucky and see an influencer in the wild. I waited for my bowl next to Ella Kahan, a sweet woman who posts at Chew York City while she filmed a spread of comped salads. New York's viral sandwich, Dot's Deli. That's how John Barr, using the handle at Haribar, described the Mac Patty at Dot's Deli, with locations in Hollis, Queens, and the Lower East Side. It's a beef patty sliced open and stuffed with macaroni and cheese, topped with oxtail, resembled and wedged between two slices of cocoa bread. Given the number of videos with over a million views and comments like booking my flight and first stop on my next NY trip, I'd steal myself for a long line. But I was met with crickets, the only customer in the shop. The thing is, I would have waited in 1,000 lines for that sandwich, a no-notes excellent treat. The craziest dinner deal I have ever come across in New York. Cask Bar plus Kitchen. And Kitchen. That's Genevieve Tankosh's claim in a video that nearly a million views, an installment of her series, A Broke Girl's Guide to Partying Like You're Rich in NYC. The deal in question? $60 for an appetizer, entree, and dessert with unlimited wine at Cask Bar and Kitchen in Murray Hill with a two-hour time limit. Miss Tankosh is one of the many influencers, a number of them paid by Cask, to post about the dinner special, which they call Bubbles and Beets. The Beets on a recent Friday night surprised me with their mid-aughts chilliness. I heard Coldplay's Yellow and 1, 2, 3, 4 by Feast over tepid fried cauliflower bites. burrata with, strangely, tomato sauce, honey and figs, and a delightful hanger steak. Is this the best deal in New York? It may not be the best deal in Murray Hill. There's a place literally around the corner that does bottomless cocktails and dinner for $50, said Lila Walter, 23, who was having drinks at Cask with friends. And it's cocktails, not wine, so we would rather do that. On the upside, as I filmed the mini espresso martini that came with dessert, a server asked me if I was an influencer. This is what $103 of Swedish candy looks like. Bonbon. Want millions of views on a video? Go to Bonbon, wait in line to fill up a Pepto-Pink stack of Swedish gummies, and head home to film a taste test. I went to the shop's Lower East Side location to watch the manifestation of thousands of those videos. The appeal is apparent. The bright buckets of candy range from delightfully sour and stretchy to thrillingly salty and anisey, a world of flavors and textures. I scrolled through TikTok and saw everyone going here, said Jaya Dillon, 15, whose parents drove her in from Long Island to try the candy. Her plan, as she walked out with an enormous bag filled with the flavors she'd seen online, was to post a Snapchat story trying the candies for her friends. For her, it's kind of a landmark, her father Raj said. All of her schoolmates are talking about it. Not long after, an eighth grade class on a school trip from Fort Myers, Florida, flooded the store. After they cleared, one shopper who hadn't discovered Bonbon on her For You page walked in. A Swedish 27-year-old named Sophie Wadringer, who had been coming to the shop since it opened. She mostly finds this frenzy hilarious, but with an apparent downside. Before I could go here, and there was never a line. Trump witness tells of tactics to buy silence, deals in the shadows. Testimony bolsters case after ex-president is held in contempt. This article is by Ben Protest, Johan Bromwich, Alan Feuer, and William Rashbaum. He was the man behind the hush money, the amiable Beverly Hills lawyer who specialized in celebrity dirt, unearthing it and then, for the right price, burying it forever. But in 2016, the lawyer Keith Davidson was on the verge of something grander than a run-of-the-mill sex tape affair. He had two clients shopping stories so big they might sway a presidential election. Their names were Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, and they were ready to tell the world about their sexual encounters with Donald J. Trump. On Tuesday, Mr. Davidson took the witness stand at Trump's criminal trial in Manhattan, telling jurors in the behind-the-scenes story of how Mr. Trump's allies bought his client's silence. His hours of testimony opened a rare window on the seamy world of celebrity hush money and corroborated key facts underpinning the prosecution's case against Mr. Trump, the first American president to face a criminal trial. In a crucial back and forth with the prosecutors, Mr. Davidson began to tie Mr. Trump to the $130,000 hush money payment to Ms. Daniels, the porn star whose payoff is at the heart of the case. Although Mr. Trump did not pay Ms. Daniels directly, his fixer Michael D. Cohen did. Mr. Davidson portrayed Mr. Trump as the hidden hand shaping the machinations. Michael Cohen didn't have the authority to actually spend money, Mr. Davidson told the jury, adding, "My understanding was that Mr. Trump was the beneficiary of this contract." The testimony punctuated a high-stakes day that began with the judge holding Mr. Trump in contempt, fining the former president $9,000 for repeatedly violating a gag order and warning that he could go to jail if he continued to attack witnesses and jurors. "The court will not tolerate continued willful violations of its lawful orders," the judge Juan Merchant said in an ominous warning to open the third week of Trump's trial. He added that although he was keenly aware of the protective of defendants' First Amendment rights, he would jail Mr. Trump if necessary and appropriate. The judge's crackdown injected instant tension into the day's proceedings before three new witnesses took the stand. The most significant was Mr. Davidson, who began by recounting his representation of Ms. McDougal, a Playboy model who said she'd had an affair with Mr. Trump in 2006. In a striking stretch of testimony, Ms. Dr. Davidson read aloud for the jury a series of off-color text exchanges from 2016 telling a National Enquirer editor that he had a blockbuster Trump story about Mr. Trump cheating on his wife, Melania Trump, with Ms. McDougal. When some of Ms. McDougal's female friends urged her to go to ABC News instead, Mr. Davidson warned that the story might slip away if the National Enquirer didn't pay and fast. Time is of the essence, Mr. Davidson wrote. The girl is being cornered by the estrogen mafia, a message that Mr. Davidson, mortified by his years-old remarks, called a very unfortunate, regrettable text during his testimony. That testimony offered another remarkable moment in a trial whose early days have been full of them. A former president, the current Republican nominee, watching helplessly as two strangers exposed details of a sex scandal that he had fought to keep secret. It has also underscored the array of evidence at the prosecution's disposal as it assembled its case. On Tuesday alone, prosecutors introduced live testimony from Mr. Davidson and three other witnesses, a string of provocative text messages, videos of Trump campaign events, and excerpts from a deposition the former president gave in a separate case, all woven into a story that they say paints Mr. Trump as a criminal. As did Mr. Davidson got deeper into details, his testimony also bolstered a key component of the prosecution's contention that the Enquirer was involved in a secret plot to boost Mr. Trump's candidacy. The publication bought Ms. McDougal's silence for $150,000, but balked at laying out a huge sum for Ms. Daniels. So the tabloid instead notified Mr. Cohen that Ms. Daniels was shopping her story, setting in motion the $130 hush money deal. Mr. Davidson provided jurors with a detailed account of negotiations in Ms. Daniels' case. Although her story of a tryst with Mr. Trump had been floating around for years, he noted that interest in it spiked after the emergence of the Access Hollywood tape on which Mr. Trump bragged about groping women. The tape sent Mr. Trump's campaign into a tailspin, but if Ms. Daniels' story got out, Mr. Davidson said it could have gotten a lot worse. When Mr. Cohen was slow to pay, Mr. Davidson recalled phoning him to say, "This is a very bad situation," warning that Ms. Daniels and her agent were preparing to go public. Mr. Cohen became agitated, noting that "my guy, Mr. Trump, was campaigning in several states that day, and I'm doing everything I can." Eventually, Mr. Cohen made the payment himself, and Mr. Trump reimbursed him. Prosecutors have charged Mr. Trump, who faces up to 4 years in prison, with falsifying business records to cover up that repayment. Mr. Trump and Mr. Cohen had a falling out years ago, and their mutual hatred had become a major motive of the trial. Mr. Trump is apparently not the only one in the courtroom to have strong feelings about Mr. Cohen, who will be a star prosecution witness in the weeks ahead. Three different witnesses offered unflattering descriptions of the former fixer. Mr. Davidson called him a jerk, and recalled that when he talked to Mr. Cohen, he was met with a barrage of insults, insinuations, and allegations. While it might seem strange for prosecutors to elicit such unflattering characterizations of a key witness, they may end up working in the prosecution's favor, desensitizing jurors to Mr. Cohen's rough edges and making him a memorable and entertaining character in their eyes. It might be working. A few jurors flashed smiles as Mr. Davidson used an expletive to describe him. The Trump-Cohen feud also surfaced Tuesday in Justice Merchan's decision to hold Mr. Trump in contempt, determining that the former president had flouted the gag order by making 9 statements on social media and on his campaign website in which he attacked the jury and certain witnesses, including Mr. Cohen. The judge ordered Mr. Trump to remove the post by Tuesday afternoon, and he did. Mr. Trump, who was accompanied in court by a larger-than-usual entourage, including his son Eric Trump, a campaign advisor, Susie Wiles, and Ken Paxton, the Texas Attorney General, did not immediately react to the judge's ruling. The decision was a nodder in relations between the court and Mr. Trump. The former president has attended every day of the trial, though he has largely been relegated to the sidelines, complaining to cameras afterward about the gag order and the judge. Now, with the financial penalty and the specter of jail time, his fury could reach a boiling point. Already, prosecutors have alerted the judge to four new potential violations. Those were not covered by Justice Merchant's Tuesday order and will be discussed at another hearing on Thursday morning. Portraying a tabloid as part of a plot to aid a campaign in 2016. The judge's decision and his questioning at the hearing last week took aim at two of Mr. Trump's typical tactics, his tendency to lie and his habit of suggesting that every action he takes is political, even when it concerns his criminal cases. Justice Merchant, for the most part, rejected Mr. Trump's argument that his posts did not violate the gag order because they were responses to political attacks by adversaries who, by coincidence, happened to be potential witnesses. Mr. Cohen has slammed Mr. Trump on social media, though last week he vowed to cease posting anything about Donald, a decision he said he made out of respect for Judge Merchant and the prosecutors. If Mr. Cohen breaks his silence, he may not be protected from Mr. Trump's attacks. The judge in his Tuesday order suggested that if witnesses provoked Mr. Trump, the former president might be free to respond. The gag order, Justice Merchant wrote, cannot be used as a sword instead of a shield by potential witnesses. The other potential witness whom Mr. Trump attacked is Ms. Daniels. The former president denies that he and Ms. Daniels had sex, and in one post for which he was fined, he attacked Ms. Daniels on his website, Truth Social, reviving a years-old statement in which she denied the affair. Mr. Trump added a comment falsely portraying the statement as newly discovered. Look what was just found. Will the fake news report it? Mr. Trump failed to note that the original statement was from January 2018 and that Ms. Daniels had recanted it not long afterward. During last week's hearing, Justice Merchant focused on Mr. Trump's lie about when the statement came to light. So that's not true, he asked Mr. Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche. That's not true, Mr. Blanche conceded. In Tuesday's ruling, Justice Merchant concluded that Mr. Trump could be held accountable for reposting other people's comments. In one instance, Mr. Trump had quoted a Fox News commentator, Jesse Waters, denigrating potential jurors in the case as undercover liberal activists. A day after the post, one of the jurors begged off the panel. Justice Merchant imposed the order on Mr. Trump in late March, barring public statements about any witnesses, prosecutors, jurors, or court staff, as well as their families. He expanded it to cover his own relatives and relatives of the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, after Mr. Trump found a loophole and repeatedly attacked the judge's daughter, whose company has done consulting work for Democratic candidates. Mr. Trump often assails people he used to praise and commends those he once pilloried. But just before Mr. Davidson took the stand on Tuesday, for example, prosecutors showed a video in which Mr. Trump had praised Mr. Cohen, who had been by his side for years. He called him a very talented lawyer. 150 people sued New York City saying they were abused in custody by Hirubi Miko. It had been a tumultuous year for Mary Soto, a high school freshman. She had been in and out of juvenile courts and struggling with her home life when an altercation with a police officer outside a party about 15 years ago led to her being held in custody at Horizon Juvenile Center in the Bronx. Miss Soto, who was then about 14, said she was terrified when the metal doors to her cell closed on her first night at Horizon. But over the next few days, she found a family of other girls who helped her navigate her new surroundings, including teaching her how to get candy, snacks, and other items. One girl told her that a particular staff member would bring her anything she wanted from the outside world if Miss Soto was really nice to him. What that meant, Miss Soto said, what she soon found out, was enduring repeated sexual assaults over the next 4 months of her detention, according to a lawsuit filed Monday. The staff member would enter her room at Horizon about three times a week and kiss and fondle her and force her to engage in oral sex, according to the suit. What happened to Miss Soto, now 30, did not happen in a vacuum, said her lawyer, Jerome Block. She was one of about 150 people who filed lawsuits on Monday against New York City, including the Administration for Children's Services and the Department of Correction, for the abuse they said they endured while in the city's custody as minors. The suits all filed through the law firm Levy Konigsberg LLP show long-term institutionalized sexual abuse from the 1970s through the 2010s, Mr. Block said. The lawsuits were filed under the city's gender-motivated violence law, passed in 2000 to allow victims of domestic violence or any crimes linked to gender to sue their attackers and institutions for damages. In 2022, a New York City law was enacted with a 2-year look-back window to file lawsuits that might have passed the statute of limitations. Overall, I think these cases show a broken juvenile justice system in the city of New York, Mr. Block said. A juvenile justice system that inflicts sexual trauma on children. Sexual abuse and harassment is abhorrent and unacceptable, and we take these allegations very seriously, said a City Hall spokeswoman on Monday. While these cases predate this administration, the law department will review them once served and respond accordingly. The lawsuits are the largest in a series of legal actions against the city and staff members at the city's juvenile detention centers over allegations of abuse and cover-ups. Last year, federal prosecutors charged 2 supervisors at Horizon with civil rights offenses, saying that they had beaten a 16-year-old boy and tried to hide their actions by filing false reports. In 2019, the city settled a lawsuit with a 22-year-old man who said that a supervisor at Horizon repeatedly sexually assaulted him during his detention when he was a minor, according to news reports. According to Levy, nearly 80% of the people suing are men, and a large majority were under 17 when they say they were abused. Many said their abuse happened in the 1990s and 2000s. A majority of the cases, 65%, are related to Spofford Juvenile Detention Center, later renamed Bridges, a troubled center that permanently closed in 2011. The rest include allegations of abuse at 2 other Bronx facilities, Horizon and Rikers Island, and people who say there were abuse in multiple locations. In 2017, New York State enacted the Raise the Age Law, which required adolescents to be housed in detention centers where they can receive age-appropriate services instead of in adult jails. In the city, 16 and 17-year-old detainees were moved from Rikers Island and placed in other facilities. The lawsuits filed Monday tell of a juvenile detention system where reports of abuse were systematically ignored and hidden. Ms. Soto said her lawsuit that she feared reporting her abuse while she was Ms. Soto said in her lawsuit that she feared reporting her abuse while she was at Horizon because another girl reported the same staff member and she was physically assaulted. The staff member who abused Ms. Soto also built a relationship with her outside of Horizon, she said, in what she said she later came to understand was grooming. When she ran away from home, while still a minor, he paid for a room for her and kept tabs on her as she got older. It took years of therapy for her to realize that the relationship the staff member cultivated with her was abuse, said Ms. Soto, who is a mother of 2 and lives in Florida. Now she wants to tell her story. The biggest reason why I am doing this is because I have a daughter and she's 2, and I never want my daughter to go through what I went through, she said, through tears, adding, you have to learn it can happen again, and it can happen to people that you love and care about. During his first month with Bronx Bombers, Soto has been sterling. For someone with Juan Soto's star power, it has been an introduction that could have been seen as a bit underwhelming, especially by the grandiose standards of the New York Yankees. Soto had learned that he was being traded from the San Diego Padres to the Bronx when he was in South Florida working out at a facility run by Scott Boras, his agent. So that's where Soto remained. His first time wearing a cap with the interlocking New York happened more than 1,000 miles away from the Bronx. His first public comments as a member of the Yankees didn't happen in a news conference at Yankee Stadium. Instead, Soto made them over grainy video via Zoom. Since then, the Yankees and their fans have gotten a much closer look at Soto. Spring training was one taste. Here are 3 takeaways from Soto's first month of the regular season with the Yankees. A once-in-a-generation player. Yankees starting pitcher Marcus Stroman has had the same answer for several years running when asking about the best hitter he has faced. It's Soto. Soto has gone 3-for-10 with one home run and four walks against Stroman in his career. But the things the Yankees right fielder does that can't be measured have impressed Stroman the most. People try to say he had a down year last year, but how he impacts the lineup is second to none with how many pitches he sees, how much stress he puts on the opposing pitcher, Stroman told The Athletic. You can't put value on some of the things he's doing. Obviously, the value is crazy, but it's even more because of some of the things he's doing, from game planning to stress. He's a once-in-a-generation player. I think he'll go down as one of the best to ever do this. So how would Stroman attack Soto if they were on opposite sides now? There's no good answer other than trusting your stuff as a pitcher because of how advanced Soto is as a hitter. Everyone's wheels start turning in their head when they face him because he has no holes in his swing, Stroman said. He knows the strike zone better than the umpire. He gets his A swing off in anything in the zone. He can hit high velocity. He can hit spin. He has no weaknesses. Exceeding expectations. Soto was a top 10 hitter last season with Padres, and the Yankees have somehow gotten an even better version of him this year. One area where Soto has been better this season compared to 2023 is the damage he's done against fastballs. Last year, Soto had a .998 on-base plus slugging percentage against all fastballs, sinkers and cutters included, with 27 home runs and a 16.4% strikeout rate. Through Sunday, Soto had a 1.145 OPS with 5 home runs and just 9.3% strikeout rate. Not only has he crushed fastballs, but Soto is also hitting the ball harder than last year. His average exit velocity has been 95 miles per hour compared with 93.2 miles per hour in 2023. He's also posted a better barrel rate, hard hit rate, and sweet spot rate while lowering his strikeout percentage, whiff percentage, and chase rate. He's been a much better defensive player than expected, too. There's so many guys that have talent in this game, and we've seen it. This guy is different, the Yankees pitching coach James Rousen said recently. He's as talented as they come, but his work ethic is unbelievable. It's relentless. He's a perfectionist. He wants every swing to be good. He works at every swing. He doesn't take anything for granted. So watching him go through his routine, you almost watch his games and look at him and say that this guy has earned the right to succeed because everything he's done before the game has been done with a purpose. You expect him to succeed. The expectations on Soto were high when the Yankees traded for him, but he has somehow exceeded all thoughts on what he could have been 1 month into his tenure. Home is where the Bronx is. Soto has said it himself. They have made me feel comfortable, he said, made me feel like I'm at home. Look, it's no secret. Where Soto plays next season will likely be determined by who gives him the most cash. Money talks, and when you're confident enough to turn down $440 million from the team you never wanted to leave, the Washington Nationals in 2022, you're not going to settle for anything less than what you want. Plus, Boris likely won't allow Soto to take a discount, especially from the Yankees. Boris' clients also include Carlos Rodon and Gerrit Cole. But as they say, the little things matter. So far, the Yankees have passed a crucial test. They have made Soto enjoy playing with them. He said that Aaron Judge has embraced him and other players have gone out of their way to make him feel welcome. He has loved working with the assistant pitching coach, Pat Roessler, whom he knows from his Nationals days. Watch him interact with Judge and Alex Verdugo in the outfield. The trio loves to play the crowd, and it's helped them bond. The Yankees clubhouse is the third Soto has called his own. Can they continue to make it so comfortable that he never wants to leave?